everybody, what going on? My name is Cheyenne. I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. I'm the co-ring master at the Universe Soul Circus. And today we represented for KPOO San Francisco. Shimma, shimma. Shimma, shimma.
Shimma, shimma. Let me in.
Shimma, shimma.
I want to be closer to you.
Shimma, shimma.
Open up your soul.
Shimma, shimma.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
love. Oh, let why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. Welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Today is Marsh Madness. It's the Marsh Takeover. The Marsh is a theater that fosters solo artists, and they're amazing. And so today, because, you know, they always have such amazing shows, I thought, let's have the Marsh people just come in and take over. So here to talk about the Marsh and introduce the rest of the crew, I'd like to welcome developing artist Raymond Harris. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So how long have you been at the Marsh?
I've been here for, all of 2025, practically.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So,
you know, we're cooking with gas over here.
All right. So for our listeners who's not familiar with the Marsh, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Definitely. So the Marsh is an independent theater. We develop new work. That is like everything. Mm-hmm. Our motto is a breeding ground for new performance, and that's exactly what this is. We boast a development pipeline that can take you from, you know, classes and kind of casual participation, you know, light involvement, to your very own full run of a show. In what sometimes feels like the blink of an eye.
So how do you determine who's going to be a part of the Marsh? How does that happen?
Well, anyone can participate. It's not exclusive.
Okay.
We have classes that you can start out with David Ford. And from there, you know, you can go on to a Monday night Marsh in San Francisco, or a Tell It on Tuesday in Berkeley.
What? A tell?
Yeah. It's like a showcase.
Oh, okay.
Like a soiree, if you will, where, right, you know, developing performers get a chance to test their mettle and put it up in front of the audience. You know, it's such a fun time. All of this, you know, leads up to sometimes a Marsh Rising performance where we put on, you know, new shows. Sometimes we have festivals that go on, and it's just this great big ecosystem, you know.
Okay, so I know that there are a lot of people out there who they have an idea for a show, but they've never done it before. They don't know anything about it. So, what's some of the advice that you can give someone who's approaching a show for the first time, and maybe, you know, is a little bit too intimidated to even discuss it with the Marsh?
Well, I think that our lineup of performers today are going to be able to speak to that pretty strongly.
All right.
I am still one of those who's maybe a little bit timid to show up with my own work at the Marsh, but it's in progress, you know, and all it takes is putting pen to paper and starting to write something, figuring out what kind of story you want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Storytelling is the medium, you know? And that's where the Marsh really shines, is it's a community of people that will help you figure out even what your story that you have to tell is. And it's collaborative, it's mm-hmm. engaging, it's environmental, you know, it's, I'll just say it again, it's an ecosystem, it's a breeding ground for new performance, for sure.
So then how do you weed out people who actually have a story to tell versus people who just think they're clever?
That's a great question. I don't know what to do with this question. I think they weed themselves out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's really intimidating to get up there and to be vulnerable and to be intimate with an audience, you know? So I think that that can stop a lot of the pretenders in their tracks, but it's, we're all pretenders, you know, mm-hmm. the men and women merely players, right?
Okay.
It's a, sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's all right.
It's great.
Right. Right. Well, then for the listener who is out there who maybe is mustering up the courage, how do they get involved with the Marsh? What's the first step?
Well, I would say those are the classes with David Ford. Oh, okay. Or just showing up and seeing a performance.
Okay.
You know, Berkeley has a full bar. So a little liquid courage never hurt anybody.
Got it.
You can spend the whole night at the theater. You can start in the cabaret. You can move on to a full run of show that's going on in the main salon there. And maybe your work gets developed in the night that you spend with us at the Marsh.
Very good, very good. Now, we've got a whole slate of performers. We've got Pearl Ong, who's been here before. We have Josh Kornbluth, who's been here before. Candace Johnson is a new face for me. I'm looking forward to talking to all of them. But do you want to give us a little a snippet of discussion about each of these performers?
Absolutely. Well, I suppose I can start by saying my experience with the Marsh. My very first show that I ever saw was actually Pearl's show, Night Driver.
Oh, okay.
And what an entry point. So, I'll refrain from saying too much about the plots of these shows because I'd love for the performers to get a chance to really shine here.
Mm-hmm.
But I started out by seeing Pearl's show, instantly became a fan, and Josh Kornbluth is doing an improv series that has been so incredible in its success that we moved him from the cabaret to the main stage. Ooh, in the emotion. Theater because we just needed to fit more people.
Oh, okay.
And Candace is celebrating the opening of her one woman musical that was absolutely fabulous. It just opened this last weekend. We just couldn't be more excited.
Okay, so for our listeners out there, the three shows we're talking about, Night Driver, What Is to Be Done, and Scatterbrain. So I'm looking forward to talking with all of them about this. But before we do, we've got a song that that Stephanie Weissman put together.
Oh, yes, I'm filling in for Stephanie today.
Mm-hmm.
She unfortunately couldn't be here, but what she's given us today is a snippet of the work that inspired the Marsh in the first place. She spent some time out on a marsh in Delaware and wrote an opera about it. And I guess the impetus for the whole creation of the Marsh was this experience. And she's very inspired by the landscape and the ecosystem. You know, marshes are really nutrient rich soil and thriving grounds for like so much biodiversity. And I think, and that was the inspiration really to go and start this endeavor. She presented the show Aphrodisia, it's called, at the Marsh. And it just muses on exactly what I said, where, you know, there's so much diversity and so much experience and so much, you know, ground to touch that it led her to the very beginnings of our humble little theater on Valencia Street.
All right. Well, let's let our listening audience hear the Marsh Aphrodisia Sampler.
Thank you.
That's a snippet of the Marsh Aphrodisia Sampler. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. I like to call it Marsh Madness, but it is the Marsh Takeover here today. Who's touching your mind right now? I'd like to welcome Pearl Ong. Hello.
Hi.
So you were here back in April talking about this show. So tell us about your experiences with the Night Driver since you were here.
Well, you know, with performance, every time you do it, it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do it, the more relaxed you get. And then sort of, you know, the better it gets, at least I think so.
So how has your performance, were there any tweaks that you made to the performance or things that you discovered in actually doing it in front of an audience day after day?
Yes. I took some coaching for acting before my second run. So that really helped. So that led to small tweaks on it that I think really helped. A lot of it is slowing down at the right places. Some of it is looking back or, you know, gesturing to something mm-hmm. that came before. Making eye contact with the audience at crucial points. That sort of thing. So that made a difference.
So I probably have a whole new spate of listeners who don't know anything about your show or people who heard the interview but, like me, have a horrible memory. So why don't you tell us what Night Driver is about?
Well, Night Driver is really an autobiographical journey mm-hmm. For myself from coming from Hong Kong as a kid. Well, not a kid, teenager, with my family and adjusting to life here. And it's a story about my mother as well, doing the same thing. And coming to this country, probably landed in LA
mm-hmm.
During the, in 1970, actually.
That's a while back.
Yeah, it's a while back. And going through all of that and then moving to San Francisco and getting into the gay scene, coming out, and that all that entails probably in the late 70s to the 80s, where there were a lot of drugs, you know, and I had a drug of choice.
Oh, okay.
So it's partially about that. So it's kind of like a throwback as well
mm-hmm.
to the gay scene in the late 70s and the early 80s, mid 80s, mm-hmm. something like that.
So as a cab driver,
yeah.
You're driving around at night. Lots of people have their drugs of choice.
Yes.
So when people got into your cab, could you kind of tell which drug was their choice based on, or was it just like, oh, they're messed up?
Well, a lot of times people would offer you a joint.
Oh, okay.
You know, and then that would be pretty clear what their drug
yeah.
of choice was.
Yeah.
And sometimes, a lot of times people were drunk. So that was pretty clear. Other things, not so much. And at a certain point, I just learned to tune people out because they began to bother me.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just, frankly, I would just get high and then I would just stop noticing that they were there.
Stop noticing that they were high.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of drugs. I think one guy got in my cab and he started passing out on me.
Okay.
And then I put him in the front seat and then he kind of like did this and I like, you know, uh-huh. and then I started slapping him and I started asking him, what did you take? And he said, Quaaludes.
Oh.
This isn't in the show, but this was one of my experience. And I said, how many? And he said, five.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. I said, who takes five Quaaludes? Nobody. Anyway.
Okay.
So, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's incredible. So as a night driver, how were you able to sort of divorce yourself from, besides getting high, like, how are you able to just sort of keep it together?
Well, just concentrate on driving, getting from one point to another point. And if I find somebody's kind of interesting, I'll start talking to them.
See, that's where you and I hate talking to people. I mean, obviously I'm interviewing people, but just like strangers get into your cab and you have to, that's a very special skill set.
Yeah. I think that in the beginning I talked more
because
I was insecure and I felt like I want them to like me.
Okay.
And then later on, it's like, I didn't care.
Right.
Right. I just want to get them from point A to point B fastest as possible, fastest way possible, and then pick up the next ride. Yeah.
Did you ever have people who, as soon as they got in the cab, they just launch into their life story?
Yeah. I mean, they in the moment, they would say, oh, I just did this and then blah, blah, blah. I remember one time when like four people got in the cab. They had already started drinking, and it was around noon or so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, something like that.
Okay.
They're coming in hot. And I think somebody just came into money because they only took the cab for like one block to the next bar and got out. You know, and they were already drinking. So,
wow.
That was super fun.
Okay. So you mentioned the story is a lot about you, your mom. Did your mom also drive a cab?
Oh, no, she didn't. They were really pretty horrified that I was driving a cab.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think they expected me to go to college. I did go to college, but they didn't expect me to drop out.
Ah, okay.
And then they didn't expect me to, start driving a cab. And I think that for a lot of immigrant parents, when they come to the States, they realize there are good things, but the other thing is that they lose control of their kids.
Right. Now you have an American kid.
You have an American kid. You've got the drugs. You've got, you know, whatever it is that they're into, what they're exposed to at school, and then that distance becomes larger.
So how were you and your mom able to bridge that distance?
I saw her on a regular basis. So we bonded on certain things. We watched the 49ers together on Sundays.
Oh, okay.
You know, and still went out to dinner and stuff. There were things I couldn't really talk to her about.
Sure.
I mean, she didn't really want to hear about, you know, cab stories particularly. Or I didn't want to tell them because it would freak her out.
Were you able to talk about your girlfriends at least?
We weren't that kind of family.
Okay.
I did bring a girlfriend or two, but it was never explicit that it was a girlfriend. And she...
plausible deniability, that sort of
Well,
thing.
It wasn't even that. Just neither of us really wanted to broach the subject.
Got it.
I think the one time she asked me if I was gay, it caught me by surprise, like she often does when I'm eating.
Okay.
And then, you know, and she asked me and I said, no, because I was like not ready for the conversation.
Sure.
And then I just didn't even broach it after that.
Okay.
And she didn't either.
Right.
She did say one time, I mean, I had a boyfriend when I moved to San Francisco, and she wasn't particularly impressed by him because he was an artist, you know.
Yeah.
And then at one point she said, oh, Ted, I mean, like 10 years later, when the train had already left the station,
sure.
And she said, oh, Ted, he was such a nice guy. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know?
You go. Yeah.
Too late.
So the show is Night Driver. When do you do it, and which marsh do you do it at?
I do it at the San Francisco Marsh. There are two shows left on Saturdays at 5 p.m. It's an hour long, and it's super fun. It's different. It's, it's got a slice of life, a lot of different things going on.
And then how did you get involved with the Marsh?
I started taking a class on a whim called Creating and Performing Your Own Work with David Ford.
Okay.
And I didn't even like public speaking. And so as a result of that, I had to do a class performance. And then somebody, Bruce Pacman at the Solo Sunday saw it and invited me to perform there. Because at first I thought, well, that'll be it. You know, I do it once and that's it. And so then I kept going. Yeah. As I say to people, you know, if I can do it, so can you. Everybody has a story to tell. Everybody's story is different. and it's all interesting.
I like that. I like that. And for our listening audience, we're going to hear a little bit of the excerpt from the Night Driver song. So let's give it a listen.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by. Let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by. Water flowing underground into the blue ocean. After the body's gone. Once in a lifetime.
Did you all love that? That's the... Once in a lifetime. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. It's Marsh Madness. We've got Josh Kornbluth in the house. How are you?
I'm doing great.
So the last time Josh was on my show, he was telling me the story about his little son who he had to take out of the incubator to talk to him and then put him back and then take him back and a little bit longer each time till the baby could finally just sort of breathe on his own. And how often do you tell your son that story?
I was telling you beforehand, we tell him that story. We also treat him like a little tiny baby, even though he's 27, and there's nothing he can do about it.
There's nothing anyone can do. Like, when you know someone as a baby, you see every iteration of them.
Yeah, yeah. He shouldn't have kept those cheeks so kissable. That was his big mistake.
And what was the name of that show that you talked about that in?
That was called Citizen Josh.
Okay, okay. And now you've got a new show. Tell our listening audience about it.
Yeah, so this show is called What Is to Be Done? And the subtitle is Fighting Fascism and Depression. And
okay.
I'm actually in improvising at the improv. I develop all my shows through improvs.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that since 89. And then starting in 90, I started doing it a lot at the Marsh. That was the first show I worked at the Marsh with was called Haiku Tunnel. I was working as a secretary, really bad secretary. And then I'd come up. The Marsh was then at this place called Morty's in North Beach. And I would like walk up from my secretarial job. And I started telling this story about being a really bad legal secretary who hadn't mailed very important letters for his boss who didn't know.
Ooh, yeah. Did the boss come to that show?
eventually. But by that time, I had covered my tracks.
And been fired possibly for being such a bad secretary?
No, they wouldn't fire me. That was the thing. That is sort of the punchline of the show is that, you know, this is, I played a temp who, you know, was afraid of going perm, didn't want to become perm, but then like they just wouldn't allow me out. I was like sucked in, and I couldn't get out. I eventually did, but
But you were terrible at it.
I was terrible, you know. I mean, you know, by the standards of showing up on time or doing the work or not using the Xerox machine to make flyers for my solo show. Like by those standards. But yeah, my boss still liked me because I could type, you know.
So that was your claim to fame, was that you could type.
Yeah,
how many
but
words
like
a minute?
It wasn't a unique skill or anything, but I guess the standards were low or something. I don't know.
I guess I love that. I love that. So before we talk about the show,
I
want to understand improv because I'm so impressed by improv people.
Yeah, me too.
It's an amazing skill to just be able to think on your feet. If you ask me for something, I'm like a deer in the headlights. I can't be funny on demand, and yet there are these people who just can immediately draw. Is it a muscle, or is it something that innate that has like you sculpt it to get it out? How does it work?
Well, in my case, I mean, it comes out of desperation, and also, I mean, I have the same admiration that you do and awe for people who do the kind of improv that you see where people go like, you're on a train and one of you is a salesman and one of you is a bear cub and you're in the style of David Mamet. And then they do like a brilliant thing. Like, I can't do that. That's just what I do is, I mean, exclusively talk about myself. And so I tell stories from my life, and then eventually I spin them out and embroider them and stuff. But I
what
found
does that mean? Does that mean embellish?
Embellish.
Okay.
Okay. I think I was. I was thinking of embroidery. I was probably thinking of my, because we were talking about how my wife makes all my shirts. So
and
I was thinking
I love
of embroidery.
That shirt. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's one of
it's
hundreds.
It's radio. No one can see it.
Okay. Hundreds that she's made. But just imagine a really great shirt, and okay. That's what it looks like. But yeah, and what I found when I first started trying to do my first show in 89 was that I couldn't write in a way like type, write, handwrite in a voice for me that sounded like me talking.
Okay.
So I ended up out of desperation just talking, just improvising.
Okay.
And then that ended up being the way that I develop all my shows. And so what I do is, and frequently at the Marsh, what I do is I just come in with an idea, like just mm-hmm. sort of a really basic idea with my head pretty blank, which is an easy state for me to reach. Mm-hmm. And then I just see what comes out and see how the audience responds. And I do that sometimes like over 100 times. And then eventually I get a sense of where the show is and I start working with the director.
Wait. So you improv 100 times,
or sometimes it depends on the show.
In front of an audience?
Yes, I mean
before
up to 100.
Before you even worked, like I'm confused. You're improvising to get to this show?
Yeah, but the improv is sort of, I mean, hopefully, I mean, people who come to the improv seem to be entertained and stuff. So, and there are a lot of people who also are interested in the development process. So I've had people coming to several of my improvs so far to see. Because I've done, I think, 5 or 6 so far. I just started on this new show. So people come to see, how does it change, and stuff like that. But then, the improv, the idea is that it's sort of, it almost like imperceptibly starts to become the actual show. And eventually, I do it word for word. And that's really a relief when that happens, when I know what I'm going to say. Like right now, I just don't know what I'm going to say. But I know the subject matter, and it's been really a thrill. This show's actually seems to be coming together faster than some other shows that I've done, I think, which is interesting and weird to me because the subject matter to me is so daunting and I really just didn't know if it would take at all with audiences.
Well,
with
what is to be done?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the premise of the show is this, that, I've had a history of depression and I have these long depressions and then I come out of them. And I happen to have my latest really deep, horrible depression that started just around the time of the last presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
So I was becoming depressed at the same time that I and everyone I know was some kind of depressed about what had happened in our politics, that mm-hmm. we suddenly had fascism coming in and being an attempted takeover by authoritarians. And it's just so scary and angering and infuriating and terrifying. So what I started doing, I have a Substack, a blog that I write, it's called But Not Enough About Me, and it's free to subscribe to. But I just started just experimentally writing to just in my Substack, in my blog, about, like these are ways that it feels similar to me. Being depressed feels similar to being under fascism.
Mm.
Like, and I just... I didn't know if that was going to be interesting to people. And it turns out it really sort of sparks some things, to get, because there are a lot. I mean, it's obvious, it's an analogy, but, like one obvious thing is that my depression would tell me to be helpless, to be helpless, be hopeless, give up.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to win, and that's what the MAGA people do, they would love for us to be helpless and hopeless, as long as we, and so many of my friends are so, we almost like disable ourselves with anger and grief,
mm-hmm.
But then we're out of the resistance. We're not doing anything. We're not resisting. And it's up to us to resist. And so I tell a story in this about, I'm just lying on the couch being really depressed. Just depressed, and then also incredibly bummed out about the politics and stuff. And my wife, Sarah, started, who, as I mentioned, makes my shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's very, she's a retired public school teacher, really talented. And but she started making these patches, and she's been making patches and other sorts of things that she gives out, and I help her a lot at protests, and she's been doing that for 15 years. They're just like fabric patches that mm-hmm. she would make with not wood block, but linoleum block, you okay. know. And they would just say things, you know, like, you know, they would have political little sayings on them that were against fascism and for democracy and for love and stuff. And she always gives them out for free. Like, she wouldn't take money for them. And so
that's her form of nonviolent protest.
It's she's very nonviolent. Mm-hmm. Although she does give out pins, which could be used for violence, but they're meant to attach the patches. And so, and then one time, like, I really wanted to go with her. We were doing a Tesla takedown, mm-hmm. or there was a Tesla takedown, as there is on Saturday at noon on 4th Street in Berkeley, where we live. And so she went, and I wanted to go, and I felt terrible, but I couldn't get out of bed. It's just very hard for me to get out of bed when I'm depressed. But then around noon, like, she called me, and she said, "I forgot the safety pins." Like, and then she goes, "I wonder if anyone could bring them to me." And I was like, you know. You know, we've been together for over 30 years, so I could tell that she met me. You know? It was sort of a passive construction, but and amazingly, you know, my therapist calls depression a starting disease. Like, it's really hard to start things.
Sure.
But once you start, sometimes you can keep going. And I just found myself out of bed because, you know, I'm needed. You know, she needs safety pins because people can't attach the little fabric thing, the patches, to themselves, and you know, and so. I hadn't been out of the house for months, and I got my bike, which I hadn't been on since forever, and I biked down to 4th Street. And then when I saw her there, it was just so exciting because there was like, I hadn't been to a protest. That was the first protest I'd been to. And there were like people, you know, with great signs, and they're chanting and they're doing all these things. And then cars are honking like crazy going down the street in support, you know, going back and forth. It was so joyful.
And energizing.
And so I went from this incredibly isolated feeling, isolated both by my depression, but also this isolated sense, like, how did this country elect those people, and how are we under their thumb now, and how did this happen, you know? And to feel sort of isolated and helpless and hopeless. But suddenly when you see other people who feel the same way and have the same hopes and have the same love for democracy, for diversity, when you see it and you're with them, you energize each other. You see it. And I even went up, I was planning just to give, you know, Sarah the safety pins and go back home. But then I like stayed and I was handing out patches and stuff. And I was handing out, I got really excited. I was handing out a patch to this woman. And I think it was one that has one of them, Sarah's patches, is of a kitten taking a nap inside a teacup, and on the teacup it says, "I hate fascism." Yeah, sort of. And you know, when kittens are roused from their naps to fight fascism, you know that we're ready for a revolution. Yeah. So anyhow, so I was handing out this patch, and this woman, I didn't know her, and I just handed her the patch, you know, and then just spontaneously, I just said to this woman I didn't know, "We're gonna win." Like that, you know, and the woman like looked at me like in wonder. She said, "We are?" And I thought, wait a second, I'm the one who just said that. Where did that come from? You know, but it came from the energy. It came from that energy. And so that was, and I started going more and more with Sarah to protest. And we went to the what was called Hands Off, the national one. And we went to the Oakland version of the No Kings demonstration. Mm-hmm. But Sarah, just through not being frozen like me, she showed me, like, she was just doing stuff. I mean, she was just as, you know, just as horrified as I was. But once you start doing things, especially in solidarity, once you start working with other people, it just keeps going.
So when and which march for What Is to Be Done?
What is to be done is playing at the Berkeley Marsh, which is on
Addison,
it's on Alston Way.
Alston Way,
it is on Fridays at 7:30, and so far it's been extended once already. I'm waiting to hear if it'll be extended again. But right now there's just two more shows that are scheduled. This coming Friday, the 15th, and then Friday the 22nd, and then. That's all we have scheduled right now, and they've been selling out and stuff. It's been cool.
Excellent. And we have some music from What Is to Be Done called Time to Ring Some Changes. Let's give that a listen, shall we?
Ladies and gentlemen, the bottom line is proud to present Richard Thompson.
Tumbling down, the walls are gone, but the roof is sound. A landlord's deaf, he can never be found. It's time to ring some changes. They'll arrest you, son, if you just stand still. They'll ask you to pause with your hand in the till. They'll ask you to die when you're written your will. It's time to ring some changes. It's time to ring some changes. Time to ring some changes. Time to ring some changes. Time to ring some changes.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Yes, it's Marsh Madness. It's the Marsh Takeover. And we are going forward with the lovely and talented Candace Johnson. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having us.
Thank you for being on the show. So, Candace, before we talk about your show, let's talk about how you got involved with the Marsh.
Sure. So, I think it was around 2017. I had put together a show of my own. Just I was hungry to perform something that allowed me to do all of the parts of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an opera singer and I teach at Cal, but I hadn't been able to do things that were really meaningful and involved all of my creative self. So I did a show called Vox in a Box, and I presented it first at UC Berkeley. And I just felt like I've got to find a place where, you know, I can do this somewhere else, and came across the Marsh online. And I thought, oh, wow, they specialize in one person performances. Okay. And I went, I was allowed to do a Marsh Rising in San Francisco. And Stephanie Wiseman, you know, the founder and director, she was there. And I think she immediately connected with my story about finding my voice. And she wanted to talk to me, not just about the show, just about that process of finding voice. And she had been on her own journey of finding her singing voice again. And we connected on that point, and we decided, okay, let's do the show Vox in a Box in Berkeley. So I presented it a few times, and then just continued to be involved. The pandemic hit, and I was able to be one of the fellows who received an opportunity each week to connect with Stephanie and other artists and David Ford. And we would, some of us would improvise, just like Josh is an improviser. I am also an improviser. And we would talk about our shows. We would help each other develop the work. And that went on for the whole time we were in what was that thing that we were doing? What do you call it when we were all together in our houses and the shutdown?
Lockdown. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, what was that?
Quarantine.
Quarantine. That's the word
Isolation.
I was looking for. Yeah. Yeah. So I was honored to just be a part of that. And I felt like while I couldn't go to church, I felt like this group of people and the work that the Marsh was doing, it became like church for me.
So I have a lot of questions for you. So I want to start with, you talk about, so you're an opera singer and you're an educator, but there's all these different voices. Now, what voice did you feel was not given the chance to shine that you were allowed to finally do?
Thank you for asking. I, as an opera singer, you know, you find yourself doing these parts, and because I have a certain voice type, I'm basically cast as the same person all the time, the little coquette.
Are you soprano?
Yes, okay. a lyric coloratura. So doing a light Mozart. And, but I just felt like those stories weren't speaking to me, and I didn't feel like I was really saying anything to other people that was important.
Okay.
So I really wanted to tell stories that were meaningful to me and might be inspiring to others. And so the in addition to the finding my own voice piece, Box in a Box, I also wanted to tell the story of Black composers because that was my specialty as a postdoc and, you know, doing work as a instructor. So I said, well, I'm not really doing a good job of writing papers and publishing them. Okay. So maybe I can take this work that I've done in research and put it on the stage. And that just started to ignite something for me. I was like, oh, I really want to tell not just my own story, but I want to tell other people's stories. And I want to be able to share the music of Black composers, but in a way that is fun and engaging for me and hopefully for others.
So who are some of the Black composers that told stories that you wanted to retell?
So what I did was I had looked at Adolphus Hale Stork. I had looked at Margaret Bonds. Those are two in particular that I had studied. But I said, nobody, I mean, we don't really know that there are these Black composers who are doing classical works and especially for voice. Mm-hmm. So maybe I can tell their life story in an interesting way. With Adolphus Hale Stork, I really wanted to center the story on an art song cycle that I had performed. Mm-hmm. So I built, basically, it's kind of like taking my life as an instructor, and I have students, I'm sharing the work with the students, and students have reaction to, oh, there are Black composers of classical music. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I start to tell these stories that, you know, my students are sharing with me as they're encountering the music. I'm telling the story of the composer's lives, sometimes bringing in the poet, for instance, with Margaret Bonds. She worked a lot with Langston Hughes poetry, and they were very good friends. So I wanted to explore their relationship and maybe push the boundaries. I had some questions about their relationship. I know they were very good friends, but could there have been more? So I pushed that boundary as I looked at the show that I wanted to put together, and that was great.
Now, you talk about being a coloratura, you can see the super high notes. So then let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Is there a role that's not coloratura that you wish you could do, but that you know, you're sort of excluded from it because you have, because you're up here, like, you know, like sopranos always want to do like husky things, you know, like gritty, you know what I mean? Like you can't be Tina Turner, you can't, you know, but maybe you can be Aretha Franklin. Like, who?
I, you know what? That's so funny that you say that. So in my Vox in a Box show, I talk about this very thing. I'm like, so coming up, I was singing, you know, as a child, and I was ridiculed because I couldn't sing like Aretha. And because she was, you know, like you said, husky and so soulful. I didn't really have any experiences to give me soulfulness.
Sure.
But I listened to Whitney Houston. That was the closest I could come to, okay, I'm going to do a few runs, but also have this really pretty voice. My voice was just sweet, and I couldn't change that. But then in terms of an opera role, I mean, something as simple as singing the role of Mimi. My voice is really not Mimi in La Boheme.
Okay. Is she the consumptive one, or which one is she?
Consumptive one? Tell me consumptive.
Oh, like who's the one with you know, who dies, you know, they cough and then they're dead.
Oh, no. Mimi, she's not coquette, but she is how can I say? She is the centerpiece, but grounded and okay, so I won't get caught up in trying to tell Mimi's story.
Thank you.
I will tell you that the type of voice that usually sings Mimi is a bit heavier, can sing over a larger orchestra than, say, a Mozart orchestra.
Okay.
And I just, you know, I guess I also about Puccini, I love the lusciousness of the chord changes in Puccini's music, the soaring melodies, but there is a certain richness and a little bit of heft in the voice that would be required, and I don't have that. I'm like Kathleen Battle.
I don't know who Kathleen Battle is.
Oh, Kathleen Battle, she is still alive. She was a wonderful lyric coloratura soprano, African-American.
Oh, okay.
And she was one of the first Black women that I saw singing opera. Singing classical music. I mean, back in 1991, when I graduated from high school, I said, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to be singing this classical music, but do we sing classical? And my sister-in-law gave me this VHS tape of Jesse Norman, a mezzo-soprano, and Kathleen Battle, Lyric Coloratura, singing together. And they were singing spirituals with an orchestra at the Met and a large chorus. And I thought, oh, so they're singing the music that I grew up with, but they're singing it in a different kind of way. This is connecting with me. And that was really what made me say yes to classical music.
Okay. Have you ever sung, I forget her name, but she does the mad scene in, what is it? Lucia di Lammermoor. Would you ever do her?
Well, so
that to kill someone.
That's definitely a coloratura like role, but I don't have quite enough steel in the voice to sustain that singing over the entirety of the opera.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about Scatterbrain.
Yeah.
So why did you choose that name?
Well, so cool. I have to tell you, I didn't actually come up with the name. Stephanie came up with the name as we were just thinking about the In Front of Your Eyes Festival of New Works by women and women identifying performers that happened last year. She said, do you want to do a show for this? And I was like, absolutely. And she said, well, what are you thinking about right now? And I said, well, I was just diagnosed with ADHD and I'm really wanting to explore talking about it.
Okay.
And so we started to think about what words come to mind when we think of ADHD, and the word scatterbrain came up. And she said, what if you take the word scatter and break it up like scat as in music? And I thought, oh my gosh, that's genius. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So do you scat?
I do scat. So, I mean, yes, I am a classical singer, but I have chosen to really cross into other genres. But I do it my way. I know I have this kind of sweet sounding voice, and I will scat and I will do some gospel, but it comes from my core, which really is bel canto, that classical place.
What's bel canto?
Bel canto is the Italian school of singing. And it's basically what so many opera singers are given as the foundation of vocal technique.
But
the Italian school, there's a German school and a French school.
And they're all in competition with each other, right?
And they all have the same core.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, same core, but just slightly different approaches.
So in Scatterbrain, what would be a song that you would do that our listening audience might actually recognize, who's not maybe versed in opera?
Sure, let's see. Well, so one of my characters sings the song Tomorrow from Annie. And there are a couple of songs that I'll touch on when I'm playing my real self. Well, yeah, I play a couple of characters that are the real me, but the current real me, who's an instructor sitting at the piano, and I do a song by Stevie Wonder. Isn't she lovely?
I love that. Yeah, he sang that about his little baby.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So what's interesting that you say, that was about his child, and then there's a song that people haven't heard where I sing about my child.
So Scatterbrain, when do you perform it and which marsh?
I am performing at the Berkeley location, 2120 Alston Way, and it's happening every Saturday at 8 p.m. except for the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. We're giving everybody a break, and I'd love for people to come out and learn a little about ADHD, or if you already know it, come see what we look like.
All right. Well, before we play My Baby, I want to give Raymond a chance to put a big bow on this whole presentation of Marsh Madness to let us know anything you think our listening audience needs to know.
Well, I mean, I'll just say what I said to start, which is that if you come to the Marsh, you can become part of it. Solo performance is so important. And, you know, the Marsh doesn't do exclusively solo performance. We host a whole plethora, a whole bunch of different ways that you can show up and be a performer and be a playwright and take off. When we've had a ton of performers take off from the Marsh as a home base. You know, we've got Dan Hoyle, Brian Copeland, Don Reed, Robin Williams did a series at the Marsh way back in the day that, I mean, hello, Bay Area legend.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, we got Josh in the house. Josh is one of those names. He was the very first person to ever do a full run at the Marsh, which is big bragging rights.
You're all in the presence of royalty.
Yes.
Okay.
We've got some upcoming shows. Boy, What They Said About Love from Steve Budd is coming in shortly. We got Lesbos Solo, My Gay History Play by Terry Baum.
Okay.
Bat and Bass on the Road, Dropitomania from Wayne Harris. I mean, there are hundreds of performances every single year, all the time, and Jazz Cabaret on Mondays and Wednesdays in Berkeley. You can come and join the Marsh at any point, just like I did. And see where it takes you.
So if people want to find out more about the Marsh and the shows that are happening, how do they go about doing that?
Well, that's on the website, themarsh.org.
Okay.
It all starts there.
All right. Well, Pearl Ong, Josh Kornbluth, Candace Johnson, Raymond Harris, I want to thank you all for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And for our listening audience, you need to hear a little something, something. I'm going to leave you with My Baby and Isn't She Lovely. Mr. Ford will be coming in to pleasure your ear hole. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.